so many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
Hello, and welcome to Geekably Yokes, the world's best married Christian geek podcast.
Or, according to your father, the advice podcast for married Christian couples?
That's right. So if you're a married Christian couple and you're in need of some help just sailing along in God's plan for your married bliss, send in all your questions to Geekably Yoked.
Because we're smart like that.
We're qualified. We could transform this into an advice podcast.
I've learned that in my pastoral role, it's best not to give advice, but merely listen actively.
And I have learned, as Ask Lovecraft, to give terrible advice to people.
Right. Yes, so Lehman's parents were here this week. And
that's right, because as always, I'm Lehman Kessler.
Oh, right, and I'm Rachel Kessler.
That's Mother Rachel Kessler.
Right, I'm a priest in the Anglican Diocese of Toronto and a PhD in medieval literature, which makes me a giant nerd.
And I am the youngest brother to a bunch of nerds who had giant amounts of D&D books and sci-fi novels in the house, which is pretty much why I'm a giant nerd.
Yes, so we had Lehman's parents and his one brother and sister-in-law and two nephews.
It was a full house.
It was a very full house. It was a little crazy. It was a little crazy. And Lehman's father is under the impression that we're running a Christian advice website.
I think they sort of hear every other word and then sort of fill in the gaps. I can probably be guilty of the same thing, insofar as when you tell me of things and I listen to them, which yes. I do as a devoted husband.
We communicate effectively.
Yes, we do. That's what some of the advice you'll be hearing here at Geekly Yoked, the world's best married Christian advice column. No, am I not allowed to do my Casey Kasem voice?
That's probably not the best idea.
Coming up next on Geekly Yoked, going to be some Jars of Clay and then some Pray for Rain.
Is this because all of your references to contemporary Christian culture are from 1996?
Something something Amy Grant.
1996 if you're lucky.
So how is your geek week, despite being inundated by my family?
Well, fortunately, being close to 7 months pregnant was a really helpful excuse to avoid every family excursion in the great city of Toronto.
Where all did you excurse to?
Well, I excursed with them to the Black Creek Pioneer Village, the little 19th century farming village.
How much cholera was there?
There was very little cholera.
How much oppressing of the Irish was
there? The best was when our friend Katie,
published fantasy
author Katie Brisky, who works at Black Creek Pioneer Village, asked our nephew Peter what his favorite part of Black Creek Village was, and he said, "Well, you mean at the village or getting to the village?" Because he really liked the subway.
Yeah, our nephew is really into public transit and sort of basic municipal infrastructure, which I guess is a good thing. I mean, I guess we need these people.
Yes.
I don't get it.
Yeah. And then I think after a little bit of prompting from his mother, he said the cookie that she gave him in the
house.
But it definitely started out with it. His favorite part of the 19th century village was taking the subway to get there.
They're very impressive subways built in like 1965 or whenever they were built.
Yes. And then I will confess that I did a little hiding from your family.
Well, you know what? I think that's fair enough. I was
hiding very loud.
I was hiding from family mostly because I was at work or at my play the entire time. For those unaware, I'm going to be, when this comes out, just finishing up a performance of Parade, a jaunty musical.
Yeah, jaunty. That's a word for it.
About a real-life 1913 anti-Semitic trial and lynching.
I spent the first act going, this is a really good play. I might go see this again next weekend after Lehman's family's gone and our friends are going to see it. And got to the end of the second act and was like, I don't need to see this again. It was very good, but I'm done.
It's a little intense.
It's a little intense, yeah.
But if you hear this and you have yet to see it, we will have a final performance Sunday the 18th, a matinee. So, you know, after church, you can come hear us sing songs about, you know, the Jews. Speaking of theater, that had been our original idea as a theme for today's show. However, in line with the actual theme for today's show, we were sort of struck by a whim and decided to move in a slightly different direction. Rachel, would you like to tell the folks what struck you?
Whimsy!
Whimsy.
Yeah, it's going to be one of these really, really fun podcasts where we decided to talk about this approximately 30 seconds ago.
Ah, they were good at those
shows. It's good. It's true.
People like our rambling, Rachel. If they didn't, they wouldn't listen to this show.
Well, I suppose.
People come for the rambling and stay for the fine Christian advice provided for our
God-loving
couples.
Okay, you can stop
trying
now.
Trying to live out God's will in everyday life. Amy Grant.
You got it.
DC
gotta
Talk. Creed.
Man, DC Talk was awesome when I was like 10.
Yeah, see, I think they didn't enter my like range of thought until high school. Like, by which point they were like, just like, because they were on the radio, so like,
oh,
I remember, yeah, they had that one song that like kind of like made it into mainstream radio, sort of like Vertical Horizon and Creed.
Right.
Oh, Vertical Horizon.
I don't remember anything they sang.
Yeah.
I mostly just remember their existence.
That's probably for the best. But no, we're not here to talk about 1990s Christian.
We've already had that episode. You can find it.
We have had that discussion. No, we're here to talk about whimsy. And specifically, I think we're looking at whimsy and the various forms of media and like TV shows and books.
Yes.
And sort of how it attracts us to these things. Like, it is this one central aspect that we keep coming back to and that we keep missing in other things.
Yeah. Well, if you heard last week's podcast, I've been watching Babylon 5.
Yes.
Moderately obsessively.
Indeed.
I got to the end of the fourth season now, and I'm like, oh, the fifth season is going to make me sad, isn't it? Everyone tells me the fifth season is just going to
make
me sad.
Is it making you sad so far?
Well, I've only watched, like, a couple of episodes. I already hate the new captain.
Oh, yeah.
But that's only because I liked Ivanova so much.
Yeah.
I really, really liked her. I mean, it's definitely like, I can see there's going to be this whole telepath storyline that's just not looking like it's going to go anywhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's definitely one of these things where, like, the fourth season ends so well and so strongly, and you're like, wow, that's, you know, clearly they were trying to squish a lot of information in.
Well, don't they, like, jump forward, like, in the future, like,
well, yeah,
a
but
whole
that
bunch? To sort of, show, like, sort of have essentially an epilogue?
Well, it has an epilogue, but that's fine. That's not, like,
it just seems weird to, like, epilogue. Oh, and now here's the stuff that happens before that epilogue.
Well, it's kind of cool. I mean, I think I sort of like that idea, because they have an episode, a really good episode in the third season.
Yeah.
That jumps forward, like, 17 years.
Okay.
And then you're sort of filling in.
Oh, okay. So they don't change the future?
I don't get the impression that that's going to
really
happen.
Even all the weird Londo stuff?
I don't know what's going to happen with Londo.
I get, okay.
But I don't get that impression.
Okay, fair enough. But so what is, what is missing?
But anyway, so I was thinking about this, and while I have really enjoyed Babylon 5,
yes,
and there's a lot in it, like, I love the way the characters have grown, I love the fact that Londo and Jakar are like a weird buddy cop movie now.
Okay.
You know, I like the trajectory of their relationship. But I just, there's something that keeps me from like that purely obsessive level of fandom with Babylon 5, which is that it's just a touch too earnest for me.
Okay, see, now it's interesting that you contrast earnestness with whimsy, because I would sort of contrast earnestness with like cynicism. You know what I'm saying?
I guess, but I whimsy is just something that's just like a touch like wacky.
Fae.
Or a touch, yeah, just like there's just something that's very stoic and stiff about Babylon 5.
No,
and there's comic relief, don't get me wrong. And I actually really, I mean, I mentioned last time that what I like about Sheridan's character, or at least the
Over Sinclair,
Bruce Boxleitner's performance as Sheridan, over Sinclair, is that he does have a glint in his eye. There is a twinkle to his character.
A Clintonian sort of mischief.
Yeah, yeah. And I really like the character of Delin. I think for all that she began, I think it's really just, I think the later seasons got a bit more levity.
Okay.
For all that the, you know, great operatic meta plot arcs get grander in the later seasons.
Yeah, more mythic.
I think maybe the characters, as the actors settle into the characters, or they, the ensemble gets more comfortable, somehow they... that the characters get a bit more nuance and a few more levels. And so for as much as I found DeLynn very static in the first season, I really enjoy her character later on. She is this, like, incredibly tough person with a real, with moments of sort of wackiness.
And isn't just a girlfriend.
Thrown in. And is not just a girlfriend. There was a little touchy there at the beginning of the fourth season.
Okay.
When
she was standing by her man.
Well, she was just whining, "Oh, John," a lot.
Okay. And fair enough. Is that what you ladies
do? She got over it. She got over it.
When I leave for work in the day, don't you just spend the time pining for me? As all good Christian women should be doing. Being good helpmeets to their hearts.
Oh my goodness, do I not need to go on the rant about the stupid helpmeet conversation?
Why, is this a lady chain I may have purposefully yanked? Rachel, let's take a quick footnote and let's talk about helpmeet.
Sorry, this is a real tangent.
It did come up when we were watching Babylon 5.
I know it did. Oh,
for those unversed. Let's describe, and I sort of count myself among that, because I certainly did not grow up with the expression "help me" anywhere near me.
Oh my goodness.
So,
well, now we're just going to get into, like, I don't want to get into, like, gender role territory, but well, like...
It's a fun discursus.
Yes, okay, but, you know, the idea that Eve is created as Adam's helpmeet, and so the...
Is that meat spelled M-E-A-T?
I think it's M-E-T-E. I worked on the Dictionary of Old English for 2 years. I should really know these things.
Oh, dear.
We'll just forget that.
Okay.
But it's definitely not M-E-A-T. It's not that kind of meat. I'm assuming meat in the sense of, like, measure.
Oh, okay. I thought it was, like, M-E-E-T, like they were meeting each other.
This is why
I'm not a medievalist or a linguist. I just do folk etymology.
Yeah, folk etymologies are fun. Anyway, so there was a, you know, for all that DeLynn has been depicted throughout Babylon 5 as this great, strong military and political leader, the Baptist pastor comes into John Sheridan.
Literally a Bible-toting Baptist pastor. They call upon, like, all the religions of Earth, and it's like a Jew, a Buddhist, a Muslim, and then, like, a Roman Catholic and
a Baptist.
Like,
yeah. But at least they did distinguish between, like, two different denominations of Christianity.
Fair enough. Yeah.
And I appreciate that. But anyway, it's going on about, like, God did not create Adam alone. God created a helpmeet for him, and you need to share your burdens with DeLynn because she's there to help you. And I'm like, she's been depicted throughout the rest of this series as being a woman with her own agency, and I'm sure would be a great, like, is a great partner for him, and they are depicted as like, you know,
they work well together.
They work well together, but, you know, the idea that she is his help. That was a rare episode where you were watching. I was watching it. I may have had a little rant.
Fair enough. All right. So anyway.
But that
same level of earnestness.
Yeah.
That they sort of did that, but it wasn't done in a kind of tongue-in-cheek style, or like someone didn't comment on that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Babylon. I think, as I mentioned last time, Babylon 5 was hit with the 90s stick in a way that...
90s earnestness?
Yeah, and I think the 90s as a decade was just a bit more...
Stoic,
yeah. For all that it... You had the genre that you like to call the 90s do-gooder show.
But that's the epitome of stoicism.
But even... And even something like Lois and Clark, which you make fun of me for occasionally watching.
Forever watching, fine.
Even that, for all that it is camp-tastic,
yeah,
it is still really, really
it's very
earnest.
True. And shows like that, and shows like, I always go to, like, Early Edition and things like that. They'll usually be, like, one sort of, like, snarky character, but that is, like, he's snarky, but he has a heart of gold.
But a great exception to this is the Mountie show.
Oh, yes.
The Mountie show is...
That's due south for
due south. Again, I think we mentioned Paul Gross and Leslie Nielsen's curling movie on a previous podcast.
Probably.
This is the show
about a Mountie who goes down to Chicago on the trail of his father's killer and becomes essentially a superhero.
But even that line becomes absurd, because by the fourth season, the producers were feeling like people didn't coming into the show didn't know the backstory, so he had to work in the line about, well, I first came to Chicago on the trail of my father's killers, and I've stayed attached as a liaison to the Canadian consulate ever since, you know. Like, the fact that that line, word for word, is worked into every episode...
It's a little silly.
Is like, it's absolutely tongue-in-cheek. The fact that his father, by the end of the show, the ghost of his dead father is living in his closet, in a log cabin, like, in a Yukon log cabin, in his closet in the Canadian consulate.
Why would that be problematic?
Like, the fact that he has a deaf, lip-reading wolf named Diefenbaker, after former Prime Minister John Diefenbaker, following him around. Like, and what I think is interesting is that due south, if you look at the pilot from where the show went, the pilot is incredibly earnest.
It's very dark, too.
It's very dark, it's very earnest, and then, like, just gradually... I think it's really when the ghost of his dead father starts showing up halfway through the first season.
Well, it's also, yeah, I mean, it also does some great things, like, they do a sort of a standard TV show thing of swapping an actor out.
Yes.
For the same, but pretending it's the same character, but then having a whole episode devoted to that same ridiculousness.
Yeah, exactly. So the main, his partner, after the first two seasons, his partner in Chicago.
Lieutenant Ray Vecchio.
Exactly, Lieutenant Ray Vecchio, leaves the show. And so he gets replaced by Colum Keith Rennie, a.k.a. Cylon model number...
I can't remember his name. He's got some dumb name.
Anyway, he's one of the Cylons in Battlestar Galactica.
Really, like, creepy, like, I'm going to breed humans Cylon.
Yeah. The blonde one. Anyway, he comes to play the same character, looking absolutely nothing like the previous Rennie.
Yeah.
And it has to do with the fact that, like... Ray's gone undercover to hide from the mob, and so he's like.
But he has to stay.
But he has to stay in his. So, like, he is literally replacing him, and it's very, very. But it's like.
And no one explained it to the Mounties.
No one explained it to the Mounties, so for a whole episode, he's like, you know, faced with people who are treating him like he's.
Crazy.
This, yeah. So. I like the fact that it is this. It is the epitome of the 90s do-gooder show. It's the epitome of the just. Earnest force for good in a world against evil, while being just utterly ridiculous.
Ridiculousness does have its place.
And again, that whimsical touch of just, this is delightful for no reason other than, like, that the fact that they have an episode with an entire train full of singing Mounties.
Yes. Why?
Because! Whimsy! And one of the singing Mounties being Leslie Nielsen.
Fair enough. Now, the other great 90s series that also went ridiculously whimsical was, in fact, Hercules and Xena.
Oh,
Hercules
yes.
and Xena, which also started off...
Did Hercules go more whimsical than Xena?
Xena, after a while, began going pretty crazy whimsical. They had an entire episode based on the plot of Footloose.
Okay.
Where they go to a city where, like, dancing is forbidden, and they just sing weird renditions of 80s... Like, just 80s pop songs. I believe Autolycus, a.k.a. Bruce Campbell, the greatest actor of all time, who once called me half a leprechaun, has to pretend to be...
wearing a very green outfit at the time.
It's very true. He had to be, like, the evil Baptist preacher and was essentially just doing, like, John Lithgow impressions. Aww. It was very strange. So, both shows are very oceanic, and I'm sure we will touch on the fact that one's proximity to to Australia lends a certain amount of ridiculousness to it.
Well, I think that's what when I mean whimsy, I think that's what I mean is just delightful and strange for the sake of being delightful and strange. That
sure
there
enough.
Needs to be a certain amount of just joy.
Yes.
In it.
Having fun.
So it's not mean humor, it's not
just dark and snarky and sarcastic.
But just whimsical. So I realize the show that I have never talked about on this podcast...
Which is ridiculous.
Just,
I blame Farscape. I think Farscape sort
of Farscape,
like,
eclipsed my heart. But this, like... This is a show that is possibly even... Like, this might be my perfect television show.
Yes.
Which is Pushing Daisies.
Pushing Daisies was pretty awesome.
And I have never mentioned it on here before, which is absolutely unforgivable. But Pushing Daisies is the show where it's like Brian Fuller went inside my head... And produced the perfect television show.
Technically, this isn't true. You mentioned this in our Lost episode.
Oh, that very first, like, test episode we did?
Yes, I think.
Did we ever produce that?
No, we never did.
Okay.
Who knows if we ever will. Yes. Maybe our 10th anniversary. Yes. Brian Fuller definitely, for a good long while, like, made up a large portion of shows that we were in love with.
Yes. Well, I mean, and they just got progressively better. Like, Dead Like Me was pretty great.
Yeah. Now, was Dead Like Me after...
No, Dead Like Me was the first
one. Was
that
the first one?
So if you're not familiar with it, Dead Like Me is a show about a, like, 18-year-old girl who gets killed by a toilet seat.
She's sort of this, like, burnout girl who's, like, flunked out of
college
or dropped out of college, and she's living at home with her mom, and her mom forces her to become, like, a temp. And on her very first lunch break, her 33-minute-long lunch hour, she is hit by a falling toilet seat from the Russian space station and discovers that death for her will not simply be crossing over to the other side, but that she meets certain personality parameters to become a Grim Reaper. And she learns of this.
Well, I think it's that she just, someone's number was up, right? And she took their...
She took, like, their spot, but I think there's also sort of like, there's sort of this, like, idea of...
Okay, destiny.
The whole sort of bizarre, like, free will and destiny, that's something they played out. But no, she essentially joins the undead bureaucracy, and her supervisor is...
Matthew Patinkin!
A.K.A. Inigo Montoya from Princess Bride.
Who just loves the taste of this key lime pie.
Well, we'll get to the role of food in Brian Fuller's works, which I think is integral to Rachel's love. But yeah, so it was this show...
Like food.
It was this show that essentially was all about death. It was all about this one girl dying.
But it was death in this incredibly whimsical way.
Yes.
Right? Like, the way death was approached and the way it was depicted was just really, really fascinating and delightful.
And just, and there was a sort of like a warm-heartedness to
it. And you love Dolores Herbig.
I love
her big brown eyes.
I loved everything about this show. I mean, you know, we can talk about my love of ensemble sort of television.
Yeah.
And this was a really good example about it. I mean, Georgia was obviously the main character, but they really did a good job of playing with the kind of the core group.
Yeah.
And Mandy Patinkin is just...
Was fantastic.
Just this amazing sort of crotchety guy with this sort of interesting, like, sort of mysterious background that you kind of learn very piecemeal.
Yeah. And then the next show Brian Fuller did was Wonderfalls.
Yeah, Wonderfalls, was a very strange, very brief show that Fox...
Well, it only aired 4 episodes.
Yeah, it was one of these shows that existed in the... that weird window of time between the Family Guy being canceled and being brought back on television when Fox had like 30 different TV shows they cycled through.
That weird period where Fox was just green lighting really creative projects and then canceling them immediately.
They were green lighting everything and canceling everything. The idea of Wonderfalls was that this sort of snarky young girl, very similar to George on...
Oh, I like the fact that in every one of Brian Fuller's shows, they get progressively older.
Yes.
So this was a 24-year-old who had graduated from Brown University with a degree in philosophy and was now and had like a hugely successful family.
Yeah, came from like the super type A...
Yeah.
Like...
And was rejecting all of that and living in a trailer park and working in like a souvenir, like a really tacky souvenir shop in Niagara Falls.
Which, now that we've been to Niagara Falls, we can appreciate.
Indeed. And suddenly the little animal figurines in the store start talking to her and giving her these really cryptic messages. And she finds herself compelled to follow the messages.
From what I've heard, from folks who saw, I never watched it, but Joan of Arcadia had
similar,
and sort of the Eli Stone sort of had similar kind of parallels.
Eli Stone, that's the show I was talking about the other day that I couldn't remember.
The Lawyer Show.
The Lawyer Show, which was incredibly whimsical.
Very whimsical.
And then the greatest Brian Fuller show was Pushing Daisies, about the pie maker who bakes pies and wakes the dead.
Also a show entirely about death.
Also a show entirely about death. It's very true. And... this is a show that just had, like, if I can think of everything that I would want in television, this show had it. It had an absolutely brilliant ensemble cast.
With a very hunky lead.
With the brother from Wonderfalls, who was my favorite character in Wonderfalls. Occasional musical numbers for no reason other than the fact that you had Kristen Chenoweth in said amazing ensemble cast. You had brilliant, brilliant verbal humor. Like the fact that, you know, in the pilot episode, they're making jokes about ruminating and chewing cud. So just very clever plays on words. And a really, really heartfelt romance at the center of the story. And yet, it was a romance that was sort of sarcastically undercut at the same time.
And some incredibly snarky characters.
Yeah, and some incredibly snarky characters. And just bright, vibrant colors, like that super saturated fairy tale feel. And just everything about the show made me incredibly happy.
Also food.
Can we just explain the importance of the food? In Dead Like Me, you had their Waffelhaus.
Yeah, so where the meeting place for these Grim Reapers, where they would get their assignment for who they were supposed to reap in any given day, was a strange Germanic, like, IHOP analog called Der Waffelhaus, which always had, like, this strange little yodely music playing in the background, and it was just this awful little diner. But even, like, the characters there even became, like, sort of bizarre, like, figures in the show that they could constantly come back to.
And then in Wonder Falls, they had the beer barrel.
Yes, and so there was, which made Rachel and I, who neither of whom were particularly big beer drinkers, sort of like bizarrely crave beer, because they were just always drinking.
And then in Pushing Daisies, obviously, they were in this pie shop. And so you just feel compelled to eat pie and watch Pushing Daisies. And just talk about pie all the time.
And cheese.
Yes, it's awesome. So again, like, I just feel like Pushing Daisies is the epitome of absolutely delightful whimsy.
Yeah.
And just done so well. And again, Pushing Daisies is a show that could very easily have become saccharine, could very easily have become too sweet. But because you had Emerson Codd.
Yes, with his knitting.
With his knitting.
The knitting
private detective. It kept it from crossing the line into just pure saccharine to still delightful.
I agree. That's very true. And I never saw Mockingbird Lane.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons. No one did. Which was Brian Fuller's last project that I'm aware of.
Yes, yes. Although he's working on something else now that I forget.
Oh, yes?
Is he working on a Hannibal show?
I have no idea. That would be bizarre.
But given his
love of food and death,
like,
that would seem obvious.
Yes,
we'll have to get back to you on that.
Indeed. Yes.
So yeah, we've looked at kind of these are all shows. I mean, they're sort of slightly sitcom-ish or slightly drama-ish. But I mean, you know, we see whimsy in I think a variety of other shows. A show that was also sort of briefly lived that we both enjoyed for a while was Better Off Ted.
Oh yeah.
Better Off Ted was ridiculously whimsical.
It was.
Like, it was, and I mean, it sort of bordered on sort of, like, being a touch more snarky than whimsical.
Yeah.
Better Off...
But it was snarky with heart.
Yeah.
Like, it was very anti-corporate and very, but, like, there
also,
was a lot of
also a lot of bright, vibrant colors.
Yeah.
Better Off Ted was a sitcom. I think it was made by the same folks who created Andy Richter Controls the Universe and a couple of other, like, short-lived, bizarre projects. But yeah, it was all about this sort of evil corporation and this, like, likable guy who worked for them and tried to, like, just help folks out. And there were the two lovable, like, lab, like, R&D guys.
And his, like, little cubicle
romance
and with a girl who stole dairy creamer because it was the only way she could stand up to the corporation was by stealing their dairy creamer.
And had Portia de Rossi kind of lending that Arrested Development sort of, like, cachet to it. It was very delightful and just sort of harmless and innocuous, but also could get very dark in strange ways.
So something that we also haven't talked about much on this podcast, but certainly falls into the category of whimsy, is Neil Gaiman.
Yeah.
We've not really talked much about Gaiman.
No, we haven't really, you know, that's very true. We have not. And his stuff really kind of bounces around between kind of super dark and super whimsical, sometimes in the same breath.
Yes, I mean, he is able to really toe that line between
creepy.
Yeah, incredibly creepy, but, I mean, Neverwhere, I think, is the perfect example of this.
Neverwhere is good. I mean, some of the Sandman stuff is too.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
I mean,
so, like,
some of the Neverwhere stuff is pretty mild compared to, like, the serial convention in Sandman.
Oh, that still gives me nightmares.
Yeah. But his stuff is, even when his stuff is really creepy and dark, there is this sort of, like, undercurrent of a kind of, well, with Sandman, obviously, there's a dreamlike quality to it, but this sort of whimsical...
Well, there's a joy of storytelling.
Joy of storytelling. I mean,
which I think is really important.
You know, the fact that one of the characters is essentially based on G.K. Chesterton.
Yeah.
You know, and is sort of affable figure, you know, who kind of crops in and out. I imagine this is why you much prefer Gaiman to someone like a China Mieville, who uses a lot of the similar visuals.
Very much so. There's a darkness and a dirtiness to China Mieville that just puts me off.
There's that same level of darkness in Gaiman, but it sort of.
But it's mitigated by something.
Yeah, it has that kind of like sweetness flowing through it.
Yeah, there's just, again, I think it's just that pure, that joy and delight of story.
Yeah.
And just that joy of fantasy and imagination and just something. There's something. Ineffable quality of whimsy.
There's a bit of a sort of fairy dust about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even like American Gods.
Yeah.
Right? Which it can be very dark.
And which
well.
Took me two readings really to get into, because the first time through I found it just to be really kind of like just stodgy and dark, but like the interstitial chapters I realized were so much of this magic lived. And reading it through a second time I was able to see it a lot more.
Well, and this brings up your favorite novel ever.
Oh, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
You're the only person I know who's read that book three times.
Oh, I am a sucker for whimsical footnotes. It's why I love Pratchett. It is why I love Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, and sort of why I can read, like, 18th century kind of comedies and whatnot.
So what is it about Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell that you love so much?
Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell is just, I'm someone who likes going on a journey in a book. I'm not a plot junkie. You know, I in fact just got into like a bit of a Facebook fight with someone over George R. R. Martin.
Oh, really?
Someone was talking about how like, oh, the way to read George R. R. Martin is just to like speed read, you know, skip the paragraphs until you see who wins a particular fight.
Aww.
And I was just like, I think I wrote, I just had to, like, I just wanted to vomit in my mouth at that. Because I like the descriptions of food, and you know, and I recognize there's a plotting quality to Martin, and you know, his last books were certainly more plod than plot. But I sort of, as when it's not Daenerys, I like seeing sort of that world, and I like sort of visiting it and seeing those people and going along with them. And Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell is pure just journey and exploration, you know, and just these little moments that are beautiful, like. There's nothing I love as much in almost any other book than early on in Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, right after the sort of the Magician Society has been defeated by Mr. Norrell and they're forced to give up their magic, and it talks about how these old men spent the rest of their days sort of tottering around their houses, pestering their wives and daughters-in-laws by asking them what time it is constantly. And yeah, it's just this beautiful moment, and I don't know if it's in the body of the text itself or in a whimsical footnote, but it tells you everything you need to know. You know, it sets the stage and lets you know kind of what the stakes are, and I love that. I love that meandering quality.
So as we're sort of defining this idea of whimsy that we enjoy so much, is part of it that, like, it's sort of gratuitous.
Yes.
It's unnecessary.
Yes.
But it just... It fills things out in a delightful way.
Well, yeah, it provides a kind of context for everything. It sort of lets you know where you sort of stand in any given world. And it's different from just straight-up cheese.
Yeah, it's not campiness.
It's not just like going into the holodeck and pretending that you're, you know, in a Western. You know, like,
yeah.
I mean, that could be whimsical, but maybe
I think there's something. There's a difference between whimsical and cheesy.
Yeah. And maybe it's a fine line, and maybe it's one of these situations where what I like is whimsical and what I don't like is cheesy. I'm willing to admit that, but I feel like there's something about. I mean, I think cheesiness is problematic because it usually is random. I mean, if we're being honest, and we go back and talk about Hercules and Xena. I mean, when you know that would that level of whimsy was certainly just like we're not going to do an episode set in modern day times, and we're going to have all the actors pretend to be the production team. Oh, but Kevin Sorbo is actually Hercules. that's drawing a fine line and sort of tap dancing on just pure cheese.
Yeah.
But like I have to in my heart of hearts believe that there is like some discernible difference between like the sort of Brian Fuller's sort of bizarre tale of pies and kind of like, you know, interposing these things together and the episodes where they go into the holodeck and like hang out with Vic
Robin
Fontaine
Hood.
or our Robin Hood.
I guess that was Q.
Yes. Which, anyway, very whimsical.
And I think there's something, I mean, as much as I love Joss Whedon,
yeah,
There are certainly moments that are, I guess, whimsical, but I'm not even sure if his level, like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, is clearly like a cultural critique.
Yeah.
On some level.
It's very self-aware.
And I'm not sure if that type of self-aware pop cultural deconstruction is the same thing.
No, I definitely agree.
There are episodes that, like the Zeppo.
Yes.
As an episode. The episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer that's all about Xander, and Xander having strange adventures while Buffy and Angel are having angst-ridden...
Didn't they do the same thing with Jonathan, though, at one point as well?
Well, no, that was more... I mean, but that was kind of a whimsical... But that was an episode where Jonathan cast a spell that made him the center of the universe.
Oh, I see, okay.
They did the same thing with Harmony in Angel.
Mm.
Like, in the fifth season of Angel, an episode where Harmony
was... It was all from Harmony's point of view. I remember that.
I mean, those were sort of delightful.
Yeah.
But I don't think that kind of ironic cultural commentary is necessarily what we're talking
about.
Well,
I think the elements of Joss Whedon where, you know, there's sort of the world is painted in this sort of whimsical thing, like when the demons pull out the kittens.
Exactly, yes.
You know,
kitten poker.
As part of their poker, like, betting. That is whimsical.
And Buffy calling Spike a neutered vampire who cheats at kitten poker.
Or the fact that you know, Spike and Giles begin having an addiction to passions.
Yes. Yes.
Or the fact that sort of, you know, Angel and that one, like, you know, bizarre, you know, cosmic guard he keeps running into sort of have small talk about,
you know,
those moments, this kind of informality.
Yeah.
That sort of, and sort of breaching of high stakes and low stakes.
Yeah.
Like, that's where I feel like we see that kind of whimsy allowed to come in. Like, it's sort of, it's sort of silly, but it's not like, it's not super like just cheesy and dumb. It's not Ryza.
And it's not...
I should just keep going back to Next Gen.
You really do just, like, slam Next Gen.
Well, I've been watching so many first-season episodes.
To be fair, that Vic Fontaine was a slam at Deep Space Nine.
That was Deep Space Nine. How about all of Voyager? There. Can I just when Star Trek does whimsy, it very rarely goes well.
Because, again, I think you're functioning out of a... Why Star Trek whimsy doesn't work is because you're functioning out of a very serious environment, right?
Except for the episode House of Quark.
Or Garak. Anything involving Garak.
Although Garak, again, has that bizarre sort of, like, sarcastic 90s, like, mystery thing. But no, like, the House of Quark episode, a lot of the Quark episodes, but House of Quark in particular, where you have Quark forcing the Council of Gowron to, like, sit around with data tablets, tracking
episodes. Sorry, I'm thinking about episodes with Quark. The episode where they do basically, like, the Magnificent Seven, only the Magnificent Ferengi.
Precisely.
Yeah, that was pretty great.
So, yeah. So there are moments of sort of whimsy, and again, of taking these sort of, like, you know, very epic sort of moments and then undercutting them. And maybe that's part of it, sort of being willing to kind of undercut yourself and not take yourself so seriously, but not just be like smirking at the camera.
Yeah, and I think that when you're too self-aware in doing it,
it sort of loses some of its
fun. Of the idea of whimsy is that it just kind of is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's why we liked, I think, early Heroes we enjoyed, because Hero himself was such this really fun, whimsical character.
Wibbles, woohoo!
Who was just sort of delightful and fun, and then as it became more and more serious...
Well, we never really liked Peter Petrelli,
despite the fact that he is one of the great love interests on Gilmore Girls. Barf.
I've told you, the rule of Gilmore Girls is you just have to ignore anything involving Rory's personal drama.
But see, I love Paris.
Well, Paris is great, but Paris isn't part of Rory's personal drama. Paris is part of Rory's comic relief.
Oh, I guess. Fair enough.
Paris is a great character.
He's pretty awesome.
You just have to ignore Rory's love life.
Oh, okay.
And that is the way to enjoy Gilmore.
That is the way to enjoy the show.
I mean, mostly Lorelai's love life, too, but it's usually at least has a twinge of...
Seriousness or
interest or,
yeah, fair enough.
You know, something. But Rory just has terrible taste in men, and
indeed
it goes badly.
Indeed, she does.
But that is a show with whimsy.
It does have whimsy, and again, that's because
they live in a delightful, like...
Well, they live in a...
Candyland, Connecticut.
Yeah. Like, that's where Once Upon a Time should have been based.
Oh. Now, that is a show that should have had whimsy that did not.
Yeah, that definitely...
And I think that's why I suffered through the first season of Once Upon a Time.
You kept going through it.
And I watched, like, the first couple episodes of the second season, and I just couldn't do it anymore. And I think it's because that show should have had something. There was a spark that show needed, and it just never got from
it. Well, yeah, every time I watched it, everyone just would have seemed like they were frowning.
Yeah.
It looked very generic. I could not tell any of the male leads apart.
Yeah, they were a little bland.
It was a preview for Pacific Rim. But yeah, there was just nothing about it that, like, there was Robbie Carlyle being Robbie Carlyle and being Rumpelstiltskin and being sort of interesting.
But I felt that, like, that show just needed, there was no joie de vivre.
Yeah.
In that show.
Everyone sort of felt like they were going through the motions.
Yeah, and I think that's what killed it for me. I know a lot of people who really, 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 really like it, but the people I know who are, like, fairy tale buffs, people who really enjoy retelling of fairy tales, don't like that
show. I feel like,
at all.
Yeah, I feel like people who like it are the same people who like Big Bang Theory. I feel like it's...
Well, we're so mean to the Big Bang Theory.
Well, that's...
Well, and again, maybe that's because that's another show that should have whimsy that doesn't.
Yeah. Whereas IT Crowd is nothing but whimsy.
Oh, yeah.
Although that's also just also pure snark at times as well. But Richard Iowade's character is very, like, lovable, and there's this degree of whimsy about him.
Yeah.
Now, a Britcom that I've now introduced you to sort of, like...
Watch one episode.
To sort of, like, give you a sort of, like, methadone for your your desire to have a whole bunch of, like, I don't know, sci-fi-ness in your world.
I just need space opera. Is that so hard?
It is. I don't even know if it's whimsical or just bizarre. Would you like to talk about your introduction to Red Dwarf? Your first initial thoughts on it?
We watched Red Dwarf.
Yeah.
It was delightful. I liked his little cat.
Yes.
I don't know if I formed a solid impression
yet. You haven't imprinted on it yet?
I don't think I've imprinted. But okay. As we know, it takes me a while to, like, my build, like, my relationship with television is a very gradual build up to, like, once I cross the point of
like, no return.
No return. Then I binge until I finish it. But like,
who's pretending?
We're get sued.
What?
That'll be a really useful theater company.
That's well, you know, Andrew Lloyd Webber's a forgiving sort of guy. Remember, all you Christian married couples out there, do not sing more than 10 seconds of any given song.
But I mean, my relationship with television usually involves a very slow build up to.
That is true.
Like, then I like, at some point when I finally connect with the characters, then I, like, I go over the hill, and then it's just the plummet downward.
I would like to point out that the thing that made you most excited about Red Dwarf was the fact that it had 9 seasons. And honestly, those are 9 British seasons, which you're like, oh, there's so much of it!
It's like the conversation I had with your mom. Your mother was just like, why would anyone want to watch serialized television?
That was very strange.
It was really, really strange.
Mother has no time for that. She wants her laws and orders and her, like, contained mysteries.
She's just like, why would anyone do that?
You have to watch every single episode.
You'd have to watch every episode.
Well, that's also a generational thing, which you pointed out.
It really is. And I tried to explain that this isn't about being home on Thursday night at 8 o'clock to watch your stories. It's, but it was, your mom definitely had a sense of, like, who has time for that sort of thing? But I think this goes into why the whole thing we're talking about with whimsy, which is whimsy is
unnecessary.
Unnecessary, right? It is not about the practical. And your mother is not a person of whimsy.
There's certain things she gets whimsical about, but no, there's certain things very utilitarian.
Yeah, and I think that what it comes back to is this idea of whimsy is just not utilitarian.
Yeah.
Right?
No, it's ultimate flavor.
Yeah.
And it's flavor in a sort of like, I don't know. It's feel good, but it's not just like schmaltz. You know,
exactly.
Seventh Heaven is not whimsical.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think this, you know, to tie this back into matters of faith, I think there is something about this that I appreciate in the Christian faith,
and not just Lord Peter Whimsy.
No, but Dorothy Sayers of the Lord Peter Whimsy Mysteries does have her compilation of essays, The Whimsical Christian.
Oh yes.
She takes this approach to the Christian faith that we delight in the story of it.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes we don't give ourselves that kind of permission to delight in our faith.
No, that's very true.
To delight in creation, to delight in God's presence in the world. And I mean, and I think that is, I mean, I think about at St. Thomas's. St. Thomas's was a church that we attended here in Toronto for a long time before I was ordained. And in Latin, they have inscribed above the altar, Sic Deus Dilexit Mundi, for God so loved the world, in Latin. And that the word for love in the Latin version of John 3:16 is dilexit, delectio, that the same word that we get delight from
And presumably today, delicious.
That God delights in us, and we are called to delight. And it's a very medieval concept.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes we miss that.
We get sort of either caught up in the kind of the hardcore evangelism or sort of social justice-y or like this.
Yeah, well,
I think
there are certainly, you know, Christianity takes many forms and many different manifestations and many different traditions, and I think that, you know, we can get, there are those of us who can get caught up in our theological debates and arguments and
Veil of tears. Isn't that what this is? Are we not supposed to enjoy the world because it's a veil of tears?
Okay.
Isn't that a thing?
Sure. But then there's people like, then there are the incredibly practical social justice people, right?
Yeah.
Who are, it's all about the practical work in the world, and they don't have time for anything that distracts from, you know, the work that we're called to do. And
they can miss some of the mystery.
Absolutely. Whatever form our Christianity takes, I think that we can always be tempted to fall into that, traps.
Well, even in scripture itself, there's sort of a strangeness that can be delightful. I mean, I talked about for years, one of the things that always would always come back to is that moment of Christ bending over to sort of dig in the dirt.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no explanation. It's just there. It's just a moment. It's just this thing that happens. And there's the Bible is just filled with these strange little sort of interludes, which don't, I mean, presumably someone can torture scripture to come up with some grand theological meaning, but in and of themselves, you know, they're just this strange little moment, you know, Saul hiding in a bucket, and you know, sort of in a barrel or, you know, just little things like that, that are bizarre and strange. The Israelites fooling a bunch of people into giving themselves circumcisions and then attacking them, you know, strange stories.
Well, and I think that there's wonder in the world, right?
Yeah.
And there's wonder in our faith. And I mean, that's part of why we are both huge sci-fi geeks and Christians, right? It's that I think both aspects of our lives convey that sense of wonder.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I definitely agree.
I mean, certainly on different levels. Different
influence. No, but they look at the world through sort of a creative lens and a creative eye, and like willing to experience it as more than either just, I don't know, a lump of matter and, you know, sort of sadness.
Well, and to go back to Dorothy Sayers, and man, if you have not read Dorothy Sayers' essays, please go read Dorothy Sayers' essays because they are awesome. And I mean, she's writing in the 1940s. I mean, she was writing her Peter Wimsey mystery novels in the 1930s.
Yeah.
And then as World War II came around, she started writing more apologetics and essays. And I mean, I think she is really responding to a world that is beginning to experience the breakdown of modernity.
Yeah.
And a world that has become so overly mechanized that we've completely lost a sense of wonder, and we've lost the sense of joy in God's creation. And her whole take is on our God is a creative God, you know, and that's the first thing we know about God in the Bible.
Yeah.
Is it Strangers and Aliens or the Sci-Fi Christian that actually has that as part of their intro?
I believe it is Strangers and Aliens.
Oh yes. Yeah. I mean, that you know, we worship a God who is creator and did not create us out of any utilitarian purpose, but created us purely to enjoy us because he chose to. And I think that's a big part of my faith.
We are certainly a superfluous, not particularly utilitarian race.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That there is something superfluous about us.
If there's nothing else we provide, it must be sort of, you know, a good sense of whimsy and wonder.
And I mean, we can even go back to
amusement.
To Augustine. I mean, St. Augustine is not really someone that one typically, like, points to as an example of Christian who had a good time.
Yes.
This is the God give me continence and chastity, but not yet, man.
Indeed.
But, speaking of which, my medieval studies department used to sell boxer shorts with that and Latin on them. Medievalists are really weird.
Yep.
Really weird. We just need to stress that. But even Augustine, I mean, in his On Christian Doctrine, I mean, his entire thing is that we are to enjoy God. And that is our great calling, is to enjoy God.
I like it.
I mean, And I feel like that's something that can really, really, really get lost in our world today.
I think that's really
fair. For whatever reason and whatever particular excesses we are prone to in our Christian faith, I think that we are often tempted to lose the whimsical nature of the Christian story.
And there you have it.
That's the end of my little sermon.
All right. And I think that's about all we have on whimsy. We have a little bit of a house cleaning to kind of deal with over the next little bit. If folks are listening to this on iTunes, we would really appreciate if you left a review, if you gave us a bit of a rating. And also, we mentioned the Sci-Fi Christian Podcast and Strangers and Aliens. We're beginning to integrate with them a little bit more and starting to form a bit of an alliance with them, as it were, and be listening in the future for the Crossover Nexus, which is kind of an interesting little experiment that we're kind of beginning to help boost our communities and perhaps be able to cross-promote ourselves a little bit better. I think there's a lot of use of the word cross because we're Christians. So there's that. By the time the next episode comes out, I will have returned from Necronomicon in Providence, where I will be doing my Ask Lovecraft shtick while abandoning my poor pregnant wife to the Arctic deprivations of Canada. How will you cope with my absence, wife?
I guess I have to watch all of Red Dwarf.
And that's how you cope with a missing loved one, good Christian women.
When you're on vacation.
Precisely. All right, well.
As I'm cowering, because we have to understand about having a staycation in our situation is that we live next door to our church.
Yeah, Rachel both lives by the church and lives by the church, so
I'm mostly cowering in the house with the curtains drawn.
In case anyone spots you, not tending to the flock.
Yeah, basically.
Not serving the widows and orphans, and instead watching Rimmer and Lister have whimsical adventures.
Yes. Oh, and I guess I should probably finish this. This goes back to our whimsical storyline.
Oh, right.
The Magicians, that stupid book.
You wanted to read it.
I know, because you told me it would be good and everyone was reading it.
People really liked it. I started reading it. I liked it. I like terrible things.
Yeah. They're all unlikable. And they're all having angry sex with each other.
Whoa.
And
that is not advice for a good Christian married couples.
Yeah, that is a book that's not whimsical.
I read The Night Circus. That was whimsical.
That was delightfully whimsical. Night Circus, Ellen Morgenstern, great book.
All right. So there we go. Read The Night Circus. Don't read The Magicians unless you're into that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Well,
on that note,
from the world of faith, family, and fandom in no particular order, this has been Geekly Yoked. Geek out, y'all.
One Orion, a Roaisha in Vulcan, and Klingon, it's Kapaha, which sort of sounds like a threat. Aijalau is Romulan, but not exactly canon, in case we make the fanboys upset.
Nikar Tele Gardarasim is Mandalorian, in and out of galaxy long gone by. If you speak Hatties, you say Umaji Muna on Dagobah.
Love you, do I?